Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Rest, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening and viewing audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Bill Clancy. Bill Clancy is the chief scientist for human-centered computing in the Intelligent Systems Divisions at NASA Ames Research Center. He is on a government detail from the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition in Pensacola. At NASA, Bill has led several partnership projects with Johnson Space Center, notably automating all routine file management between mission control ground support and the crew on board the International Space Station. His team has received the NASA Ames and Agency Honor Awards and the Johnson Space Center Exceptional Software Award. Bill has also participated in Mars mission simulation during 10 field sessions on Devon Island in the Canadian High Arctic and at the Mars Society's Desert Research Station in Utah. From 2001 to 2008, his team developed a voice commanding system that was used by geologists at Luna analog sites in Hawaii and New Mexico for science data collection and navigation. The system was also demonstrated for coral reef surveying by scuba divers at the Smithsonian's Research Atoll in Belize. Bill was the founding editor-in-chief of AAAI, MIT Press, and senior editor of Cognitive Science. He is a fellow of the Association for Psychological Science, the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, and at the American College of Medical Informatics. In 2004, along with the NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe, Bill was selected as a member of the top 100 by Irish America magazine. Bill has published more than 50 journal articles, 40 book chapters, and 6 books, including Situated Cognition on Human Knowledge and Computer Representations. He has made presentations and keynote addresses in over 20 countries. Bill's forthcoming book, Working on Mars, is about the scientists who have been conducting field science on Mars using the Mars Exploration Rovers. Please join me in welcoming Bill Clancy.
So, are we on? Okay, good. So my presentation this evening is about the Mars Exploration Rovers, which are twin robotic laboratories that began operating on Mars 88 years ago. It's been a long mission. One of them is still being used to explore the Martian surface. My story is really about people and robots and how they relate to each other. The Mars Exploration Rover mission, also known as MER, M-E-R, challenges how we usually think about the role of robots in space exploration. It provides a new way of understanding how computer tools and social organization can be orchestrated to extend human capabilities. Now, for over 40 years, we've been exploring other planets and their moons with robotic spacecraft. Whether flying by beautiful blue Neptune, like Voyager in the 1970s, orbiting Saturn, like Cassini, or roving on Mars, like MER, these spacecraft must be computer-controlled because the distances are too far for us to control them directly from Earth. So we can joystick a rover on the Earth's moon. It takes about 1.5 seconds for the signal to be received. But at the speed of light, Mars is about at least 5 minutes away, and sometimes 20. Radio time to Jupiter is on the average about 45 minutes, and Saturn is twice that. When the New Horizons spacecraft reaches Pluto and its moon Charon in 2015, after a 9-year flight, it will take about 4 hours before we know whether the mission was a success. Given the great distances, we can't go to these places in person anytime soon. So to carry out a scientific study, we must repeatedly reprogram and redirect the spacecraft, specifying where to go and how the various instruments are to be used. Science teams working together for 5 or 10 years or more interpret the data that's returned, and they discuss with engineers what's interesting and possible to do next. So at its heart, the story of planetary exploration today is about the relation of people and robotic spacecraft, machines that are actually complex laboratories, capable of operating in extreme cold with little power, packaged to handle the vibrations of launch, and work for years without repair. Sending these scientific instruments throughout the solar system is one of the great successes of the computer age and will surely mark our place in history of science and exploration. But these missions also show that we understand how to design machines and organize people so everything fits. And that's my story tonight about the Mars Exploration Rovers. How the design of the spacecraft, the organization of people, software tools, and the work schedule makes it possible for scientists to work on Mars. So in the scale of the universe, Mars is right next door. It's about 9 months' travel using conventional chemical rockets. Mars is about half the diameter of the Earth, but it lacks oceans, and so it has roughly the same surface area as the Earth, and that's a lot of landscape for us to explore. The climate is often colder than the Antarctic, with great extremes during the day. But on a summer afternoon on the Mars equator, you could survive wearing something like a pressurized, lightweight scuba suit with a helmet. Now, actually, a scuba suit might have been appropriate 3 or 4 billion years ago. We believe Mars was more like the Earth then, wet and with a thicker atmosphere. One striking elevation map created from orbit shows the lower areas colored blue and suggests that large parts of the northern hemisphere might have been covered in seas, and there's evidence for ancient shorelines. So what happened? Did life form on Mars? Why was its atmosphere lost? Are microorganisms living today below the surface? If life formed there, did it form separately from on Earth? Or are we related? These are the big questions, and it's why people are so excited about Mars. Now, as I've said, we can't directly control the spacecraft on Mars because of the time delay in seeing and affecting what is happening. But by acting through programs that control the rovers and their instruments, people have been working on Mars for over 8 years. Two teams of scientists and engineers operating the twin rovers called Spirit and Opportunity have driven together over 25 miles of sand dunes in and out of a dozen craters and climbed hills hundreds of feet high to analyze the layers of deposits. And they've also stopped to admire the views and take photographs. The scientists have scraped rock surfaces, microphotographed their texture, and analyze their molecular composition. In February of 2004, a month after landing, I had the privilege to observe mission operations at the Jet Propulsion Lab, JPL, in Pasadena, California. The two rover teams had twin facilities on different floors, and they lived and worked in the time zone of their assigned rover. Because the Martian day is longer than Earth's, that means they reported for work about 40 minutes later each day. The main science meeting room was darkened so they could orient to what they called Mars local time. Each team had about 75 scientists and research students organized into science theme groups: mineralogy and geochemistry, soils and rocks, geology, atmosphere. They were arranged at their own tables, and they gave presentations to the group, interpreting what they were learning and what they'd like to do tomorrow on Mars. The long-term planning group, sitting off to one side, reviewed the overall mission engineering objectives, measures of distance, the number of images, and instrument analyses, and how these goals would affect tomorrow's plan. In the words of Steve Squires, the principal investigator of the Mir mission, "This has been the first overland expedition on another planet. Applying the rover's tools at chosen spots along the Martian landscape, we've learned how water has altered the chemistry of the soils and rocks of Mars, and we've found places similar to where life thrives on Earth. Home Plate, for example, is an area behind the Columbia Hills, about 100 meters across. It might be a remnant of large hot springs, like those we find in Yellowstone Park. So this is how planetary science proceeds, by recognizing minerals, formations, and processes that are familiar to what we understand on our home planet. The success of comparative planetology on Mars is partly why it's such an exciting place to study. We're on another planet, but it looks and feels a bit like home. Maybe the Southwest Desert. Just as the Mir scientists make analogies with Earth, my study of field science on Mars starts by comparing it to how field science is done on Earth. Since the late 1990s, I had been joining Mars scientists on an expedition in the Canadian Arctic, a nearly lifeless landscape called Haughton Crater on desert Devon Island. The scientists chose this place because it is Mars-like, allowing them to understand how and where life exists in extreme conditions. And the expedition itself reveals how people might live and work on Mars, which is of interest to mission planners. So on Devon Island, I followed the scientists in the field to understand how they explored, how they decided where to go, what samples to take, what tools they used. I documented how they collected and organized their samples, which they were going to analyze with instruments in their laboratories back on Earth. I studied what they diagrammed and described in their notebooks and how this related to their published work. And I observed especially that they tended to work alone or in small groups. Observing the scientists in Pasadena, I was taken by the contrast immediately. The scientists are indoors, in a dark room, part of a large team, doing everything by consensus. People from different disciplines are required to work together. Geologists who in the Arctic I would see race to the nearest outcrop on a hill to survey the landscape were working with mineralogists who wanted the rover to stop and take a new sample every few meters. And among them were laboratory scientists who had never done work in the field before. So working through a rover remotely creates a new way of doing field science. The new practice changes the scientists and leads them to relate to their tools, the rovers, in unexpected ways. So how could the scientists work together under these conditions? How could they accept the anonymity of a mission team where their names would never be associated in the public press with any of the decisions of what rock to analyze, how long to stay, and what the data means? How could people used to seeing, touching, and roving at will in studying a landscape, how could they do that through a programmed laboratory? How was it possible at all to do field science on another planet while remaining here on Earth, let alone keep these people engaged for 8 years? The key is that although the scientists can't directly see and control what is happening immediately, the design of the rover's instruments and computer software makes it possible for them to be virtually present on Mars. Through the combination of stereo and spectral images and being able to move about, scuff the soil, scrape the rocks, they experience being there. For example, Steve Squires described their landing. "We realized we had landed in a crater, probably Eagle Crater, and that's where we were. And then we noticed, 800 meters away, maybe we can make it. There's Endurance Crater. Wouldn't it be great to actually get there?" Squire's descriptions are all in the first person. "We had landed. We noticed. Maybe we can make it." So in this imaginative projection, the scientists become the rover. And this experience of being on Mars is essential to the success of the mission. It enables them to actually do field science. To know what rocks and soils are nearby and what they can reach or how long it might take to get someplace, they use a combination of 3D images, computer graphics, and simulations, often overlaying them. These visualizations allow them to point to places, give them names, and control precisely where new photographs are taken and where the instruments are going to be placed. So, for example, they can draw a yellow bounding box to specify where a camera should zoom in for a more detailed image. Each photograph can be used like a map of an area on Mars because its location relative to the rover is precisely registered in the planning program. As we move in from panoramas used for navigating to detailed images of outcrops and rocks, we can see and mark up more and more of these places on Mars. Even small rocks and patches of soil might be named, and they become targets for, say, an atomic spectral analysis or a microphotograph. Combining these planning tools with their imagination, the scientists can work as if they were on Mars. Jim Rice, a geologist on the mission, said, "I put myself out there in the scene, the rover, with two boots on the ground, trying to figure out where to go and what to do, how to make that what we're observing with the instruments. Day in and day out, it was always the perspective of being on the surface and trying to draw on your own field experience in places that might be similar." David Demaray, an astrobiologist, described it this way. "The first few months of the mission, they had these huge charts on the wall, engineering drawings of the rover with all of the dimensions. We'd have some geometric question. Well, can we see this? Can we reach this? Is this rock going to be in the shade or is it in the sun?" So we'd go and stand and stare at those charts. And over time, we stopped doing it so much because we began to gain a sense of the body. That's projecting yourself into the rover. It's an amazing capability of the human mind that you can sort of retool yourself. So acting through the robots they control, the scientists look around, manipulate materials, and move over the landscape. They may pretend to be the rover, crouching down and gesturing with an arm to better imagine what's reachable. And through the eyeglasses of special cameras, they can directly see, for example, iron minerals in the rocks. They are transformed in a way to a kind of cyborg on Mars. Now, that's all pretty different from doing field science on Earth. But this is an odd kind of expedition for another reason. Usually, scientists go off in different directions at different times using their own tools. For MIRA, the entire team is all there together, 150 scientists and engineers balancing together, as it were. I think of it like on a giant skateboard, creeping over the sand, up and down over the hills and craters, just meters at a time, like your ankles are all tied together and you're standing there. I've also thought of it as being like a ship in an early voyage of discovery on Earth. The scientists and the sailing crew all have to travel together, and they have to negotiate how long to stay and where to go next and what to do at each site. So this requires a well-coordinated understanding of roles, schedules, resources, and long-term plans with a clear chain of command. If you visited the Science and Engineering Coordination Meeting during the Prime mission, the first 90 days of landing on Mars in 2004, you would see the scientists up front, on the bridge, as it were, with huge displays of the Martian surface that lay before them. Behind the scientists, as if below decks, were the engineers, arrayed behind big square monitors showing the ship's power, memory, and an evolving time plan for tomorrow's work. This coordination meeting would occur about 6 p.m. local Mars time every day. The scientists arrived at work in Pasadena, JPL, about 3 hours earlier, mid-afternoon rover time, ready to receive the photographs and the instrument analyses, the result of the rover's work during the day. So the rovers, the MERS, are solar-powered, so they work on roughly a 9-to-5 schedule, local Mars time. So between dinner time on Mars and sunrise, the scientists and engineers must finalize a plan, followed by a second shift of engineers who refine and test the program before it is sent to Mars. Now, if that weren't enough, keep in mind we were simultaneously operating two rovers on Mars for over 5 years. Spirit and Opportunity were, in fact, two missions operating in parallel. They had their own meeting rooms for science operations at JPL, their own engineering programming teams, their own 6 p.m. coordination meetings, and their own cache of free ice cream. But the teams shared a single mission control center where the engineers attend to monitors like those you might find in Houston's Mission Control. Their computers are connected to banks of satellites and Earth stations that communicate with the rovers. This common engineering activity required the two missions to be coordinated in a special way. If you look at the map of Mars with the landing sites of the two rovers at Meridiani Planum and Gusev Crater, you'll notice that we landed the rovers about 180 degrees apart near the equator. Most people will realize that the sun angle will be most favorable for solar power near the equator. But few people realize how the geography of the mission relates to the problem of commanding the rovers every day. By placing Spirit and Opportunity on opposite sides of Mars, we're able to use a single command center and management organization operating around the clock that focuses on one rover at a time. Controlling them is separated by a half a day on Mars. This illustrates why understanding and designing a mission as a total system of people, tools, facilities, and, in fact, the landing sites on Mars is so important. It affects the scheduling of how the facilities are used and their operations. So I've described the logistics, the tools, the mental projections involved in working on Mars. But there's another angle to how people talk and think about the rover that I found fascinating and also very strange. It's how the rover becomes the hero of the story in official reports on the web, in the press, and even the scientists' own publications. What I've learned is that anthropomorphizing the rover is both practical and poetic. It facilitates the scientists' work and helps them to work together as a team. And it also provides a way to express their feelings. NASA's 2001 press release announcing the MER project epitomizes the personification of the rovers. In 2003, NASA plans to launch a relative of the now famous 1997 Mars Pathfinder rover. This larger cousin is expected to reach the surface of the red planet in January 2004. This new robotic explorer will be able to trek up to 100 meters across the surface each Martian day. Scott Hubbard, the Mars program director at NASA headquarters, said, "This mission will give us the first ever robotic field geologist on Mars." Now, the metaphors in this poetic narrative, such as referring to the earlier mission as MER's cousin, are simplifying for the public's understanding, but they also serve as a kind of cultural cheerleading in praise of America's new robotic explorer. Years later, the tone was distinctly sentimental when the Associated Press reported Spirit's demise. Spirit, the scrappy robotic geologist that captivated the world with its antics on Mars before getting stuck in a sand trap, is about to meet its end after six productive years. The melodrama of the rover is told here in the genre of a lost person. Spirit is said to be incommunicado, and it's personified like characters in a Disney animation. Quote, as far as sibling rivalry went, opportunity was the overachiever, while Spirit was every bit the drama queen underdog. Surprisingly, the lead scientists are quoted as speaking in this same way. The mission's deputy investigator, Ray Arvidson of Washington University, said he will remember Spirit as a fighter. Quote, it wouldn't quit, just like the little engine that chugged up the hill. Now, sometimes this poetry is perhaps a bit overdone, but then we find quite serious descriptions of the rover's character and its accomplishments, like a moral in a children's bedtime story. The plucky rover will be remembered for demystifying Mars for the masses. This is a story of perseverance. Now, talking about the rovers in this way, in the third person, makes it possible for the scientists to tell us about themselves and how they feel about the rovers and the challenges that they encountered. This is a personal, emotional presentation that you're not going to find in their journal articles in Science or Nature. Now, the metaphor of the robotic explorer actually appears in the first books about planetary spacecraft in the 1970s, and it has become a journalistic cliché. A few years ago, Andrew Chaikin subtitled his book Intrepid Explorers of the Red Planet. The book is about the scientists' passion for Mars, but in Chaikin's poetic wrapping, the intrepid explorers are the spacecraft. Over the past decade, this cliché became a conceptually somewhat confused debate in the space exploration community between the advocates of science, meaning robotic spacecraft, and exploration, meaning human spaceflight. Partly, this was a debate about the control for money. But a genuine question remains about the relative roles of people and robots as the distances beyond Mars make daily reprogramming more difficult. And the robots are becoming more able to identify what's worth studying. Some have summarized this dichotomy as human explorers versus robot explorers. At a Stanford University symposium, Humans and Robots in Exploration, in 2008, one topic was, when does the human become the tool of choice for solar system exploration? By this phrasing, people and robots are both tools. And then they asked, what is the right mix? Of course, viewing people and robots as interchangeable tools from the start is absurd. I believe some of the difficulties in talking about people and robots arise because a new working relationship has developed. The spacecraft that fly by a planet carrying out a canned program and send the data back in a one-time package are one kind. But mobile laboratories with sensors and manipulators that can be programmed every day for years provide a qualitatively different kind of experience for the scientists. This new way of working, which Murr epitomizes, can be difficult to think about because it is a relation among people, technology, and processes, not a property or a capability that can be ascribed to people or robots independently. And that's why the term robotic geologist is so misleading. The relation of people and robots in practical work has been difficult even for the scientists to describe. You'll read many articles where the Mars scientists say, I could do in a day what took the rover many months. But they're mostly thinking about those long drives. Astronauts would leave the rovers in the dust. But there's no shortcut for the hours required to do a spectral analysis or a pixel-by-pixel infrared panorama. Nobody's used instruments like these in the field before. So how the rover's automation and human actions are dependent on each other can be difficult to explain. because we don't think about it in practice. In terms of phenomenology, the rover, we say, is seen through. The rover is embodied in our activity. It becomes transparent, like a hammer, a bicycle, or even an automobile. We hit, we ride, we go places. We don't have to think about the machinery. It becomes part of us. The rover's arm reaching out is the mere scientist touching a rock on Mars. Jim Bell's book shows the difficulty of talking about this embodiment. The title is Postcards from Mars, the First Photographer on the Red Planet. As the panorama camera lead, he's referring to himself. He writes that the rovers have allowed us to be, in a sense, the first photographers on the red planet. He puts scare quotes around the word photographers, but I would have put the quotes around on the red planet, because Bell and his colleagues really took the pictures, but they were not actually there. So how shall we describe this? Who sent the postcards? So I believe some of this poetry is revealing that the joint action of people and robots is difficult to think about and to describe. Now, the phone cameras that many of you are carrying in your pockets provide a good example of how viewing robots as being free agents and giving them credit for doing the work can easily arise. Cameras today are all computerized. So when you press the button, computations determine the exposure and other settings, and they may even decide that you're taking a portrait and focus accordingly and compensate for backlighting. But still you'll say, I took this photograph. Now separate the button press and the creation of the photograph by something between 30 and 240 million miles and add an overnight delay. Now you want to say, Spirit took this photograph today. All the people and technology in between drop out. It's a narrative shorthand. Philosophically, it raises a question of agency that's at the heart of the humans versus robots debate. Ascribing agency to the rovers appears throughout the scientists' writings. For example, in the Planetary Report in 2007, Matt Gollenbeck, a lead MER scientist, provided a superbly readable technical summary of the science. The title was Spirit and Opportunity, Martian Geologists. In a clear presentation about the ancient processes that formed and altered the rock and sand materials near Mir, Gollenbeck alternates poetic attributions about the rover's actions with the scientists' observations and their conclusions. Quote, after exploring Endurance Crater, Opportunity drove south to investigate the heat shield it used during landing. Next to the heat shield, we noticed the only rock seen for kilometers on the plains. Opportunity's investigation of this rock revealed it as a nickel iron meteorite, a very exciting finding, as it was our first discovery of a meteorite on another planet. Since then, Spirit has discovered two others. Now, it appears that Spirit caught on pretty quickly at how to recognize meteorites, doesn't it? When I first heard the term robotic geologist, I thought the phrase was just hype, unfair to the people who were actually doing the work. And it turned the mission story into kind of a puppet show or something like The Wizard of Oz. Pay no attention to the scientists behind the curtain. I worried this would confuse the public and was obscuring the real story about how people were able to work on Mars. People might also begin to wonder, why should we send astronauts to Mars if we already have a robotic geologist working there? Now, I've already mentioned how viewing the rover as a third person out there on Mars provides a way for the scientists to talk about themselves. And over time, I've come to realize that this perspective also has many practical benefits. As an obvious example, superimposing the rover's route on orbital images provides a bird's eye view of the regions that have been explored. We hover over the landscape, seeing Mir from orbit. The third-person view of the rover is also expressed vividly in computer composites that show the rover working alone on Mars. It makes you wonder, who took this photograph? Does this express a wish to be present and to make tangible the images the scientists and engineers have in their minds? Or is it yet another practical projection, another way of understanding the rover's orientation and context, which facilitates doing the work? Here we see the interplay of art, imagination, and science, motivating and enabling each other. Now, other less dramatic computer graphics composed with Mars images are used routinely to orient the planning and programming of routes and targets. Such third-person views provide an important way of locating the rover, and then by projection, locating yourself in the work on Mars. There's yet another way of relating to the rover, the second-person perspective. When the lead MER rover driver said he viewed the rover as a partner, telling me, the rover and I work as a team, he didn't mean it was the same as working with a JPL colleague. Instead, he was using the best words he could find relating to the rover as a peer to express how he delegated work to the rover. So it planned portions of the route that he didn't have sufficient data or time to analyze and program himself. He relates to the rover in terms of what I do and what you do. For him, this second-person IU relation is practical. The rover is an agent that you can rely on. Talking about spirit and opportunity as investigating, driving, exploring, and so on has probably also taken hold because it fits so well the convention in scientific writing of depersonalizing contributions. Reports focus on the goals, the methods, the data, conclusions. The emphasis is on Mars, not the scientists, or how they do their work. Individual scientists are also properly wary of taking the limelight when everyone knows that they work as a team. And in this respect, I was especially surprised to learn how the robotic geologist metaphor had been pivotal in designing the rover itself and promoting teamwork. A central concept in the original MER mission proposal is that the robotic geologist is a physical surrogate for the science team. Unlike the boxy spacecraft that we send to orbit or fly by planets, MER was deliberately designed to personify a scientist. About human height, somewhat short, with stereo vision, mobile, with an arm holding a hammer and hand lens and other sensors. Combining the disciplinary teams into one persona, MER realized the vision of one instrument, one team. The team's ability to identify with the rover is fundamental to MER's design, as Steve Squires explained. Quote, the whole idea behind MER is that these tools work together. Look at the silica discovery. The mobility system, but by which he means the rover's wheels, trenches up some soil. We notice it with the PanCam wide-angle camera. We hit it with mini-tests to check for iron. It looks interesting. We go over. And we figure out its molecular composition with the APXS. Everything works together. Having instruments that work together encourages the instrument teams to work together. This was Squire's vision, and he called it science systems engineering. He said, you've got these sensors, and each of them provides complementary bits of knowledge. You're going to use the payload to the fullest advantage if people look at it as being entirely at their disposal. If you were out there in the field, this is still Squires, doing geology with your field partner, you might be arguing about what this rock means or what that rock means. But you're not going to be arguing about, well, should we use the rock hammer or should we use the compass? We don't have PanCam guys arguing with mini-test guys, but rather geologists arguing with chemists about exploration. This design and organization starkly contrasts with almost every other planetary mission. For example, the Cassini spacecraft, now orbiting Mars, has 12 instrument teams, each with its own principal investigator. These are matrix with discipline teams, having different turfs, studying the planet Saturn, its rings, the moon Titan, the icy moons. It's at best a consortium sharing a single platform, jockeying for control and resources. The scale and reality of being two boots on the ground enables and requires a completely different technical design and social organization. Rather than features at a planetary scale, MERS instrument targets are palpable and directly manipulated. Viewing the rover as a geologist surrogate makes sense. Now, typically, a robot is viewed as an automated machine acting without human intervention. But the vision of the robotic geologist was broad and multidimensional. Instead of replacing the scientists, the robot geologist was conceived as a collaboration tool, a way of getting the disciplinary teams to work together. It combined with the virtual reality planning tools and commanding every day that enabled frequent individual contributions, the MER exploration system helped scientists to forge a new kind of collaboration. It made them agents on Mars, working through a mobile, programmable laboratory. So although many people speak about people and robots in space as if there's a choice, human explorers or robot explorers, our relationship to these computer-controlled devices is much more complicated. Envisioning the field science, the scientists become the rover, a first-person view. They are on Mars. Programming the rover's drive, an engineer may view the work as a joint accomplishment. For him, the rover is a partner, a second-person view. Working as an ensemble, acting together through the rover's hardware and software systems, everything turns inside out in the third-person perspective. The rover becomes the team, and they can write about its exploits proudly. I would paraphrase the Associated Press story about Spirit's demise by saying, this intrepid team of scientific explorers will be remembered for demystifying Mars to the masses. This is a story of perseverance. The MER scientists and engineers have invented a new practice of planetary science. These are their footprints on Mars. In the robotic geologist metaphor, the team tolerates and in some ways revels in their anonymity. The more fantastic the historic exploits of Spirit and Opportunity, the more proud you can feel to play even a small part in the mission. This projecting of personal ambition onto the group's effort and their accomplishments is no small part of our power and joy as human beings. So the accomplishments of MER are intricately based on relating technology to both the psychological and social nature of people. It is a textbook example of how to design a complex system of people and machines. Now, the MER mission objective was to travel about a third of a mile, in a 90-day mission, taking perhaps dozens of photographs and learning something about the history of water on Mars. In an extended mission over an unimaginable 8 years, we have traveled over 25 miles and taken almost 300,000 images and spectral scans. The science itself could fill a textbook. Now, with a somewhat elderly craft, we have arrived with opportunity at a deep crater 14 miles wide called Endeavour, with clay soils and new layers to investigate. Using high-resolution images and scans from orbit, we've identified interesting mineralogy. And after this Martian winter, we will set a course for Solander Point. Opportunity will almost certainly spend its last days or years here. The next Mars rover, a relative of MER, is on her way to land in Gale Crater in early August. If we're successful, we will climb and explore its central mound over several years. It's actually a mountain towering 3 miles high over the landing site on the floor of the crater, and it's been built up for perhaps 2 billion years. NASA calls this rover the Mars Science Laboratory, or MSL. It's loaded with new instruments and weighs about a metric ton, 5 times MER. Perhaps with the name Science Laboratory instead of Robotic Geologist, The Mir experience has clarified the true nature of these spacecraft as tools for the scientists. And perhaps this time they'll place themselves more publicly in the driver's seat. But you can be sure there will be more poetry. Like Spirit and Opportunity, MSL has been personified by a nickname. They call her Curiosity. And you can guess how that will play out. Thank you.
Our thanks to Bill for his comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience and viewing audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, Voyages of Scientific Discovery with the Mars Exploration Rovers with Bill Clancy. Now we open the floor to a Q&A, and I'll be passing around the microphone. If you have questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone and make sure to speak into the microphone. Questions?
Well, I'm a little surprised that, you know, since they're trying to get the public buy-in on these kinds of programs, and this is sort of replacing the human element, that they don't sort of nickname them like Bob and Tom or Lisa and Joan or something, because I think the public could relate to that much more than these names they come up with, and people can't remember which is which. So has there been any talk about giving them more human names?
Curiosity is very human. I actually don't know that aspect. I know that Spirit and Opportunity were chosen in a kind of school competition, and that was selected. I think Curiosity was similar, but I haven't been involved in that. I'd say write a letter to JPL and make your suggestion. It's certainly better than Mir A and Mir B, you have to say.
Thank you, Bill, for a very wonderful presentation. You talk about the teams as always agreeing. We know more about human beings than that. Can you say something about how the teams settled arguments and differences in values and things like that?
I think that's a good question. I highlighted it as a difference between people having different ways of doing science. So if you're going to be wanting to stop the rover every few meters versus get to the top of the Columbia Hills in a couple of days, there's a conflict. And so early on, Dave Demaray, who was the lead of the long-term planning group at the time, came up with what he called the four-day, or what on Mars we called Martian Sol, a Martian day, four-sol quartet. The quartet. And so it was arranged that within every four souls, everyone would get a chance, each of the groups. And they rotated in that way. And so that was a major way of providing some sense of planning and expectation to the group. I did observe that probably the group that in this mission had more often the short end of the stick was the atmosphere group, because their instrument pointed up, and I think there was a sense of, well, we can point up tomorrow when we're over there, you know. So yes, of course, there's some discord in with the odd hours, you know. But what I saw in the nine people I interviewed was a uniformity, and no one had any stories to tell me. They wanted to highlight how this mission was different from all the others. And one of the kind of jokes, I don't know how accurate it is, it's been passed around, is that in the telecons for Mir, because, of course, they went back to their home organizations after 90 days, they would ask at the end of the telecon, is everyone happy? But on the Cassini mission, they would ask, is everyone equally unhappy? So,
we'll take another question.
So the MERS were originally planned to operate for 90 days, at least that was the public face. And they're is this enormous program going on for 8 years. To what extent were the sociological and psychological and team interactions projected to possibly go on for a long period of time at the outset of the mission, or how much had to be done by the bootstraps as the mission went on and on?
I think it was very much from the interviews, and you can also read a bit in Squire's book, Roving Mars. It was very much improvised and day by day. So there was always the sense, especially I think more at the beginning, today could be the last day. And they know they're writing it with every instrument and every plan. They're writing a history book, and they wanted all of the data to be valuable. So they described it as, this was their own metaphor, we work as if there's a sniper up on that hill. And I think when you go on, you have no idea that you're going to survive the first Martian winter, a couple hundred days out. And when that happens, then they learned a bit about how to go on. But now the rovers are constantly getting older. And part of the story, I think, isn't told is they are falling apart. And if you read the details of the reports on the JPL website, you'll see that Opportunity's arm doesn't quite retract, and it's a lot easier to be driving backwards. So these are images. We don't have any movies to show what this looks like, but I think we'd feel pretty sad and sorry for these rovers. A wheel gets stuck, and the heater of one joint isn't on. So it's patchwork, and they never know when the end is going to be there. So I think they developed that organization and feeling among themselves. We just keep going.
Okay, we have the mic back here. So you just mentioned the degree of personification of the trials and tribulations of the rover. Another one I've heard is that the reducing solar power due to dust is called starving the rovers. What I wanted to know is that in these cases where we have a individual scientific instrument, a large number of people involved in it, and a high value placed, there we've seen personification, but both in cases where there's less humanity in the item, i.e. Cassini or, say, a software robot searching the web for us, and also in the cases of those software robots when they're more disposable, less personification, less interaction. Have you seen anything about the MER and its structure that is likely to generalize to human societies on Earth that we see more and more having proxies, having agents that are not human doing work for us, as you mentioned the camera?
There are people doing studies of robots in cognitive science, for example, and I'm seeing more as a reviewer these kinds of papers coming by, Japanese robots that greet people in a store and so on, and trying to understand how different cultures and different age groups and so on respond. So it's clearly a topic of study. I would also emphasize that the MER scientists are never confused that Spirit and Opportunity are out there working and doing things without them. And I think that's what's of interest in the story, that it's how you talk about it and write about it that turns out to be useful to you. But still you go about knowing that you're programming it and you're in charge. And maybe when we interact with our robots that clean our house or whatever, it'd be similar. You know, you can have multiple perspectives at once. Well, I've also been reminded that Spirit and Opportunity were female, and I've tended to refer to them as heroes, but they were heroines. Yes. Yeah, that's,
That actually leads into my question. I was curious, throughout your talk, you referred to both of them in gender-neutral terms, and that's the first I've heard that they were female. But then with the new rover, you were distinctly referring to her as female. And I was wondering if that's because they're like ships and they're always women, or if there was some sort of conscious decision that they were going to be female. And kind of also in that same vein, because of the different histories of the two rovers, the two MER rovers, whether there was any difference in the way that gender was spoken about between the two rovers.
Actually, I didn't hear a lot of talk of the scientist referring to the rovers as he or she. So I think that neutralization is in that view. You won't see, I think, in Gollenbeck's writing where he says opportunity explored, opportunity investigated, he doesn't say he or she anywhere, just repeats the name, maybe it. So, but, you know, when you're telling your story and writing it, there's poetic license and you do whatever sounds good.
Now we'll take two more questions, and so who have the burning question? So
two, okay. There's one question over there. And
yeah, so Bill, would you like to point?
This gentleman's been asking for a while.
It's actually a quick question. With curiosity weighing like a metric ton, is there any mechanism for unstucking it if it gets stuck in the sand or in the soil, or is it just a function of maneuvering around areas that may be dangerous?
Well, the mechanism is the body. It's a lot taller. And so the problem with spirit is it high-sided, if that's the right term. It drove over some harder piece of rock that wasn't sand and got stuck underneath. So it that was holding it in place. And then as it spun its wheels, it is now hanging there. These rovers are much bigger. The way they're described is the size of a Mini Cooper, and the wheels are humongous compared to Mer. And there's great photos on the web if you look. So that's the most important thing. And I would imagine certainly to be moving that mass, these are the motors and all are correspondingly stronger.
So they don't really get stuck in the soil itself.
Well, you know, I think if I were going to make a prediction, you know, we'll drive it more aggressively and, you know, it'll slip and so on. But I think in this particular area, there might not be that same kind of driving for months over sand dunes. And even Opportunity got stuck, and for more than a month, we were trying to wiggle it out.
When the expectation was not greater than 90 days, or even if you doubled that, I would imagine some of these people were on leave of absence from universities and other research. Well, when it kept going, how did they handle the personnel problem? Yeah. Because surely their agency or whoever was employing them eventually wanted them back.
Right. So it was planned that after the first 90 souls, people would leave Pasadena. They'd no longer just be all together running those meetings together. But they'd go back to their homes in different countries. And they worked remotely, of course, from that point. So they were time-sharing. They weren't for, I don't know exactly how the transition went, but certainly as the years go on, they were not full-time on Mer. And the work, and they were going out in the field and doing other things and calling in and so on. JPL had to do a lot of adjustments in the number of engineers because they were needing to be assigned to other missions. Fortunately, MSL was coming along. And so they ramped down very dramatically, and I have some of that in my book. I don't remember the numbers right off, but they had to work that again. And where it was forced upon them was each renewal for the NASA budget. Because this became an extended mission, and the amount of money drops, and so you have to scope down. And they were not commanding every day. They moved to more like 5 days a week, and they had some plans could be for multiple days that they would upload to the rover and so on. There were ways of cutting back.
So maybe we'll take the last question here, this gentleman.
These instruments are a manifestation of the human mind. And maybe in that, they are a guidepost for where we need to be mentally, because they're actually the epitome of the capability of the human mind. And maybe the lack of emotion in that unit can lead the way toward a less emotional populace.
you were taking it in a way I wasn't expecting there. That I was going to say about the lack of emotion is great, and that I don't want a robotic assistant that gets emotional on me, or is able to say, "Oh, well, I work for somebody else." You know? So, But I don't know that that was really a danger. If you read what goes on in the press, an attribute. Well, I saw a lot of emotionality in the scientists. And in fact, their willingness, and I give Squires especially special credit for saying that it's okay to take a photograph at the top of a hill because you work so hard to get there and the view is beautiful. And does it have a scientific value? We don't, you know, at some point they have to be allowed to say that's not the reason why we did it. We did it because it was cool, it was fun, it was the right, you know, it's what anybody would do. And Squires and a few others have been willing to talk that way. And I think that's what the missions need, a more bringing out of their emotionality so people could relate to them more, and maybe not just changing their names, but see what the scientists are experiencing, their pleasure.
Okay. Our thanks to Bill for his comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as the listening and viewing our audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.